Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Ethnographic Marginalia, a special series on the New Books Network. I'm Sneha Anavarapu.
And I'm Alex Diamond.
And we are the hosts of this special series.
Ethnographic Marginalia brings together a set of conversations around ethnographic practice. In each episode, we will converse with an ethnographer about their research design, process, and fieldwork experiences.
This special series centers the dilemmas, tribulations, mistakes, and pleasures that go into doing ethnographic research. We hope to use the conversations that transpire on this podcast as an opportunity to build community amongst ethnographers in various disciplines.
Towards this end, we also have a website where we publish field notes, ethnographic essays, photo essays, and methodological reflections.
Please visit our website, Ethnographic Marginalia, at www.ethnomarginalia.com to know more about how you can publish with us. We really look forward to hearing from you.
Before we proceed with this episode, we'd also like to thank our sponsors, the Ethnography Incubator at the University of Chicago and the Lozano Long Institute for Latin American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin.
And on that note, let's begin.
It is my pleasure to welcome today's guest, Dr. Sarah Brain, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research uses quantitative and qualitative methods, and most importantly for our purposes, ethnography, to examine the social consequences of data-intensive surveillance practices. Sarah is the author of a wonderful new book, Predict and Surveil, Data, Discretion, and the Future of Policing, which draws on ethnographic research with the LAPD to describe how law enforcement uses predictive analytics and new surveillance technologies. In the book, she shows that the use of big data and algorithms by police widens the scope of the criminal justice system, results in massively increased surveillance, and reinforces stereotypes and discrimination. Sarah, welcome to the program. Congratulations on a really thought-provoking book, and it's a tremendous pleasure for us to have you on.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So Sarah, let's get started with getting to know you a bit better. How did you become an ethnographer, and you know, how did you get interested in police surveillance in particular? We'd love to know more about that.
Sure, yeah. So I sort of have a longstanding interest in the criminal legal system. I think in part, you know, growing up in Canada, there's a lot of similarities between Canada and the US, but one of the big differences is simply the massive scope of the criminal legal system in the US. You know, the incarceration rate is so much higher here than in Canada. And I always sort of was interested in why and what that looks like. It was sort of this peculiar social fact to me. So when I started grad school in the US, I thought I was going to focus on mass incarceration, but I became increasingly interested in sort of like the front end of the process, the feeder mechanisms into the criminal legal system. And so I started by using some survey data to sort of statistically model what happens when people come into contact with the criminal justice system. So like if they're stopped by the police, arrested, convicted, or incarcerated, how that then sort of shapes their involvement with other institutions that are important, like healthcare or financial institutions, that type of thing. And so I did that research, and then I quickly sort of realized that we didn't have very much pre-existing data on the other side of the equation, on like the people who were doing the surveilling, the police. And that was where ethnography really came in, where I realized, you know, if I want to understand how surveillance is occurring, you know, what police are doing, this type of thing, I was going to have to collect my own data myself. And so that was my first foray into ethnography, basically, was needing to collect my own data. So I decided to focus on the LAPD after sort of, you know, I wanted to study how police were using big data. And instead of trying to focus on some representative department or something like that, I really wanted to look at one of the most technologically advanced departments mm-hmm. to sort of answer these research questions. Mm-hmm. And so, but I had no existing ties to any law enforcement agency. So, you know, I tried to get access to the LAPD, Chicago PD, and NYPD at the same time, and would just sort of go wherever that access took me. And LA ended up being what worked out. And I'm super grateful because I just feel like, you know, the things I was able to observe and the people I was able to talk to was so illuminating. And now, I mean, now I'm totally addicted to ethnography. So I'm sort of sold for life on that.
Well, you're in the right place, or at least we hope that this is a good place
yeah,
for that.
Yeah. The ethnography lab is great. Totally.
You're all addicts to the ethnography.
Maybe we can go back just a little bit in that research process, because I think it's really interesting to hear sort of how research interests and field work unfold together. So in your book, mm-hmm. you talk about starting with federal agencies and technology firms, even like surveillance industry conferences, before mm-hmm. you came to the LAPD. As you were doing this, and I think you're a graduate student at this point, right?
Yeah.
Did you have the same basic research questions? Were these changing as you sort of moved through different, I guess, research spaces? How did all of that unfold?
Yeah. I mean, so I think the sort of descriptive questions, if you will, of like how do criminal legal authorities use data? How does surveillance happen? You know, what are the different sources of data? What are the technologies that are used? Those descriptive questions didn't really change over time, but the analytic ones really did. And that like ends up being the focus of a lot of the book. And so, you know, for example, when I started the research, I had no plans to study police resistance to these new tools. Mm-hmm. You know, I, in retrospect, naively assumed that they would sort of embrace a lot of these new surveillance technologies, and they would say, you know, it increases their surveillance capacity, you know, data information is power, great. But on my very first ride along, I was sort of disabused of that notion, where the police were quickly realized, you know, these technologies actually put them under increased surveillance as well, not by the public, but by their managers. And so they resisted those tools. And so, you know, on my very first ride along, I was like, wow, there's really a labor story here that mm-hmm. was not in my original research questions when I proposed this project. But, you know, that ended up taking the research in sort of a different direction. So, yeah, I mean, I think the descriptive questions stayed relatively constant, but what ends up actually really being like the analytic meat of the book was quite unexpected. And I like that. I mean, that's sort of one of the benefits of ethnography is you, mm-hmm. you pivot based on what you're seeing and, what people are saying and that type of thing. And so I think like the flexibility that ethnography allows there is very helpful for these sorts of questions where, there isn't a lot of pre-existing research on the topic. You know, you're mm-hmm. going in relatively open to what you might find.
Yeah. So in the book, you explain that to protect the anonymity of your participants, you can't really go into detail about, you know, how you gained access to LAPD in particular. But you just mentioned that you'd reached out to Chicago PD, NYPD, and LAPD, and LAPD worked out. But you did mention that you started high in the organization and started developing these relationships. So we are curious to know how you presented your project to potential police participants and how they responded. Was there a lot of skepticism and suspicion? We imagine that's the case. But what was that process like in trying to get people on board?
Yeah, so I mean, the way that I presented the project was very much in terms of the descriptive questions of, you know, I'm interested in how the police leverage data and technology in order to do their jobs, in order to do their jobs better. And then I would ask questions in terms of the profession, saying like, how does it make your work easier? Does it make it more difficult? That type of thing. And so I think that like the way that I was received, I mean, one of the main things that sort of was revealed over the course of the fieldwork is there's so much variation within a police department. And I think that this is like some of the one of the weaknesses in sociological portrayals of law enforcement or of the police is they're kind of portrayed as a monolith. Sometimes it's like the police do this, the police do that. And, you know, there's like 10,000 people in the LAPD, all with like different, you know, mandates, positions in the organizational hierarchy, just like personal preferences, this type of thing. And so, you know, some folks who were really into technology, they were some of the, you know, early adopters of data-driven policing. They were these like tech enthusiasts. They believed in evidence-based policing, sort of true believers, if you will. They were pretty open to talking to me because they were proud of what they were doing. You know, they were like, we are a leader in the field. We're making policing better. Like we're doing a good job and using data in these effective ways. And I want to show you, like, I want to show off how well we're doing here. But then with others who, you know, in general were a bit more resistant to these kinds of things, they were very resistant to talking to me. So I definitely would have interviews that were like, we would sit for literally half an hour and I would ask all of the questions and like every answer would be, that's law enforcement sensitive. That's law enforcement sensitive. That's law enforcement sensitive. And, you know, that's like, that's interesting data in and of itself, I guess, you know, that that interview existed. But yeah, I definitely had some sort of like fruitless interviews, if you will, in that sense. But yeah, I mean, I think that generally there was also a little bit of a base level of, I don't know if skepticism is the right word, but just like hesitance to talking to me because my role was like a little bit unclear in the sense that they understand what journalists are, for example, and they really didn't want to talk to me if I was a journalist. And they understand what like students are, like an undergrad, maybe doing a project or something like that. But PhD students, like we're weird, you know, like we're these like in-betweeny kind of like, yeah, I'm going to write a book in like 5 years about this. And like, I don't know. It just, and so I think that unfamiliarity or ambiguity often played out in my favor insofar as like it was a relatively non-threatening role to kind of come into the department as just like, hey, I'm really curious. And I think you guys are using tech and data a lot. But yeah, so that was sort of how it was. Some people were very open to talking to me when they wanted to sort of brag about how they were using data and surveillance tech. And then others just from the get-go, we're not into it.
Yeah, this actually reminds me so much of instances in my own fieldwork because I did some fieldwork amongst traffic police in the city of Hyderabad. And the thing is that Hyderabad is kind of known for being a very technophilic sort of, you know, city and like aspiring to a tech leader status in India. So it also percolates in imaginaries around policing and there was a very similar kind of, I guess, yeah, there were these two camps. So some police were always bragging about Hyderabad having high tech policing. And there were others who were so skeptical of it. And just, it was different because it's a post-colonial context and it's different in that many police would just say that Indians will not respond to tech. Like you need a stick, right? Like all these sorts of assumptions around what people respond to, right? And, but yeah, there was really that confusion in their minds as to like who I am. And they're like, and then I would hear these rumors about myself. And I heard one time that someone from New York Times is here and I kept looking for this reporter and turns out they thought I was from New York Times.
My gosh, that's so funny.
Because it was like, oh, she's from the US. And for some reason they thought I was from New York Times. And yeah, but you're right. I also felt like the ambiguity kind of played out in my favor, especially in these sorts of sensitive-ish settings.
Yeah.
Where it's better to have less defined an identity, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, that's super interesting, looking for the New York Times reporter that ends up being you. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
So kind of along the same lines of how people responded to you, Sarah, when not so much in the interview setting, but when you were doing ethnography and maybe specifically ride-alongs, do you think your presence affected police behavior? I mean, I'm sure that it did, but how? And I'm thinking specifically, yeah. There's this really interesting vignette in the book where you're riding along with an officer and he pulls up at an intersection and just starts running the license plates of cars that are around, like to see if there's any sort of outstanding warrant or whatever with mm-hmm. those cars. And then turns to you and asks, what you think about that, if you think it should be allowed or not. So, I mean, that's like a sort of telling vignette in terms of the police themselves sort of being aware of your presence. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, look, I study surveillance. That's like my focus. And I think that, ethnography is a form of surveillance itself, right? Mm-hmm. Like we are, I'm not their employer, but I am a person watching them and taking notes on their behavior. And I think that it would be, naive to think that my presence would not affect that. Of course, it's impossible to observe the counterfactual of what they would have done had you not been there, et cetera. But I think that you can put some pieces together to try and make some inferences specifically about how or in what direction your presence might be biasing your data or shaping your data, shaping their behavior, that kind of thing. So, imagine if somebody was watching you at work, you would probably kind of be on, at least at the beginning, kind of like on your best behavior. If someone's like, oh, hey, I want to see what it's like to be a professor or to be a graduate student, you probably wouldn't immediately go on Facebook all day. You would try and actually do some of the stuff that we're supposed to be doing, right? And so I think sure, maybe that observer effect fades a bit with time, but I think in general, thinking about this of how one's presence is biasing the data. So I think in the instance of my field work, I think it was basically conservatively biasing what I was seeing, meaning I likely observed officers being more compliant, engaging in less controversial practices than if they were not being surveilled by an ethnographer or by someone else. And I think that, that direction of the bias is a bit less problematic than if it was occurring in the opposite direction in this case, because I think, in fact, what ends up happening basically is I'm understating some of the dynamics and the interactions and the claims that are of interest going on in the field, right? But I think there is one exception to that, or there's probably a bunch of exceptions, but there's at least one exception I can think of to that dynamic, and that's to do with gender. So I think that, I'm a woman, and I think it's something under 20% of sworn officers in the LAPD are women. And my sample of respondents was even fewer than that. And so I think that, the vast, vast, vast majority of research subjects I was interacting with were men. And so I think there was sort of some machismo type thing going on, some dynamics with that. So, I don't know how officers would have behaved had I been a man. But I am able to discuss this question with colleagues who are men who have done field work with the police. And of course, it's not the same officers, but you can do some interesting kind of triangulation and comparing and contrasting there. And I think that there was a gendered interaction dynamic that really played out.
That's really interesting. And I wonder, sort of following up on that, if even the way that they treated you, given that you were a woman, but also given that you were surveilling, right? You just said ethnography is a form of surveillance, which I think is really insightful. You write about their, and you just mentioned their resistance to some of this surveillance. At the same time, you're in a very different way, obviously, but you're also surveilling them. So yeah, you wrote about that they lumped you in with pencil geeks, words, I think, who worked with data.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I guess we are pencil geeks and
definitely
in many ways.
Yeah. For the record, that's what you are, for the record, yeah.
That's completely accurate, true. But yeah, I'm wondering if there are ways that your presence wasn't just, you know, potentially contaminating the data, but may have also even allowed you to understand how they were reacting to this surveillance, or even if they were enlisting you as an ally in a way to show that one of the things you write about is not just that they were resistant to being surveilled, but that they were also sort of felt like their street smarts were being discounted as less valuable than big data algorithms.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think so. So like I'll first follow up on the gender thing and then talk about sort of the ally thing. So with the sort of gendered dynamics at play, I think in some instances it was sort of a paternal interaction dynamic. So like one time I was on a ride along and the sergeant said something like, you know, it was dusk and he was like, "Oh, we have to get you out of the ghetto before dark." It's like, okay. Or on another, the sergeant told me that he was speaking with this woman in Spanish, and unfortunately I don't speak Spanish, so I don't know if this is true or not, but he you know, said that the woman saw me in the front seat of the cruiser and she asked if it was like take your kid to work day. And so there was sort of this like paternal thing that played out a bit. And then in other instances, like it wasn't really paternal so much as more of exerting a machismo type thing, which I mentioned earlier. So on one ride along, we were at this like particularly gruesome crime scene. This child had been, they thought he was stabbed, but he'd actually been shot. Anyway, it was in the middle of the night and my teeth were kind of chattering. And I think that it was a really long ride along. And I think so my teeth were chattering, like partially from being cold, partially from being tired, and partially it was just like a bit of shock from like all of the blood. And the sergeant gave me his jacket. And, but first he checked the pockets and kind of like performatively was like, "You never know what I could be hiding from my wife." And so that was like a little bit different. Like that wasn't really like paternal. Well, it started off being kind of paternal, but then it sort of became this like machismo thing. But yeah, I mean, the second question insofar as like enlisting me as an ally, I mean, that came up a lot wherein, you know, officers would want to demonstrate like the continued importance of their street smarts, their lived experience, their on the ground knowledge of crime, of policing, of the city. And so, you know, a lot of the time they would say like, so, okay. In one instance, for example, he had his predictive policing map where you have these like squares basically where future crime is likely to occur. And the sergeant was, you know, saying like, "This is basically BS. Like, why is there a square there? I know where the crime's at. Like, I don't need an algorithm to tell me where they are. And look, I'm going to show you how stupid this is." And so then we drove to one of the predictive boxes and it was basically like a pile of dirt near the airport. And there was like no people, no crime, obviously. And he used that to be like, "See, like I could have told you there wasn't any crime there. You know, I'm the one who's been out here pushing the black and white for the past 20 years. And like, I could have told you that." And so there were these sort of like instances in which they would, I think, kind of like, you know, invalidating the predictive algorithms or saying like, you know, "I'm the one who actually knows this information." So that was kind of interesting to me too.
Yeah, no, that's really, really interesting. Again, like so much of this resonates with several police ethnographies in the global South as well. I mean, I've been excited to think through your book when I'm writing stuff on policing of my own, but now I think this behind the scenes is getting me even more excited.
I don't write about a lot of this in the book because you always have to just leave so much on the cutting room floor.
I know what you mean. So, you know, you talk about building relationships with participants as part of your fieldwork, and you know, I was just curious to know, have you maintained any of these relationships, and or have you had the opportunity to hear from any of your participants who've read your book or articles, or you know, listened to any interviews or panels you've been on?
Yeah, I mean, I maintain some but few relationships. So not with mm-hmm. not with most of my respondents, but with a few. And to be honest, no, I don't think any of them have like listened to any, you know, panels or read, you know, paywalled articles or whatever. But I did mail copies of the books to some folks. And but most of my sort of experience in like seeing how my respondents react to my work is in two ways. Like one is I wrote an op-ed in the LA Times, which is like, you know, very public facing. And mm-hmm. so they responded to that quite directly. And mm-hmm. then also during my field work, I would come to my respondents sort of in follow-ups and say, you know, like, oh, here's like a one page description of some of my key findings to sort of like get their reactions. I mean, part of it methodologically was like, I really need to get the descriptive empirical data right. That was really important to me because I think that like a lot of officers and then subsequently me, when I read like media portrayals of police use of surveillance tech, it's like overblown, factually inaccurate. And like part of it is because there's so much secrecy around it, but like I really, really, really needed to get the fact right. And so I would come to them and say like, look, is this the right acronym? Did I describe like, you know, how you do this correctly? But then also I would share with them like some of my normative conclusions, you know, and they would, you know, always agree about the factual accuracy, or they would correct me and then I would correct it. But then there was like some disagreement about the sort of like, so what, the implications or the conclusions that as sociologists, you know, we're pushed to go to that kind of like next analytic level. So, you know, right. For example, one of the arguments in the book basically is that the proliferation of all of these like dragnet surveillance tools, these tools that gather information on everybody rather than just those like under criminal suspicion, results in the police surveilling all of these people who have no direct police contact, right? And so one of the captains I talked to, you know, I told him this is one of my arguments, and he's like, I disagree. And I was like, okay, like, what about automatic license plate readers, right? Like, these are dragnet surveillance tools. They collect readings on everybody rather than just those under suspicion. And so you can track like people's movements through the city and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, okay, fine. But like, I would say that's an exception. And for me, like it sort of is emblematic, but for him, it was an exception to the rule. For me, it kind of was the rule, you know? And so that's like one of the sort of points of disagreement type things that would come up. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's funny. You always think you're like more important to people than you actually are in a way, you know, right? Like it's like, it's when you're like, oh, did they like listen to interviews with you? Like, no, yeah. No, they didn't. They're like doing their jobs. They probably forgot I even existed, a lot of them.
Yeah.
But that said, I maintained relationships with some of them, not in sort of a research subject way. Like I don't have an open IRB protocol, but you know, for me, it's been really interesting talking to a couple of officers as everything has played out over the past couple of years with, you know, for example, the killing of George Floyd or the election or, you know, BLM protests, the defund movement, making it into mainstream discourse and that type of thing. And it's just been very interesting to me to have, you know, phone conversations or text conversations with them. It's given me sort of a level of insight into how they are thinking through some of these things. So that sort of has been how the ongoing contact has played out.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched upon something so key here, right? Like, especially when working with or, I don't know, talking to people. I mean, I like the distinction between police as organization and police as institution, right? Like, they're like two different things in a sense. And I completely agree that organizationally, there is a representation of police being a monolith, which is problematic because it doesn't get into the labor dynamics of the police organization itself and the hierarchies and all of that. And then there's police's institution and like its effects on society. And at these moments, like with the George Floyd situation, like I guess, I mean, again, speaking, thinking of my own research, like I did have relationships with interlocutors get very strained because of the rise of political fascism in India, right? Like very quickly I picked up that like there were some inspectors and like senior officers who were so clearly pro, they were pro a lot of the violence that's happening in the country right now. And it just, we've drifted apart mostly because it's just, how do you talk to people who you like fundamentally disagree with in a sense, right? But then again, I think it is important for the insight that it gives in times of crisis. And I don't know if there's a severing of relationships on your end because of any of these events or incidents, and or whether it was just like it just took a different
route. I mean, I think that like when it became apparent that these weren't like flashpoint crises, but this was like just the world order that was going to continue. The conversations just sort of petered out a little bit. Like I'm Canadian, for example, so I can't vote, but like, you know, a lot of them would message me like, if you could vote, who would you vote for in this election, that type of thing. And, you know, those types of questions. But it's, I wouldn't say, so the ones that I have had ongoing relationships with, they haven't been severed. They've just sort of petered out. But that's really interesting thinking about it in your context too, how there's a lot of overlap.
Yeah, I think there's like so much emphasis on ethnographic research on rapport building, but I think we are not very well equipped on what do we do when, we don't really get a sense of how to handle the spoiling of relationships because of, I guess, political events, right? Like that's not something that just like not a totally thing that came up.
Totally. Yeah. You should write something on like ethnographic ghosting or something.
That's nice.
Now, there's a clear politics in your book, Sarah, which I think is admirable and it's important, right? That, you know, this surveillance that you're describing isn't treating everyone equally. They're, you know, particular marginalized Black and Brown communities that are bearing the brunt of this, you know, very related to all the George Floyd killing, Black Lives Matter protests, et cetera, that you mentioned. I can imagine, I actually don't know what the LA Times op-ed piece said, but I can imagine that it manifested those politics. Were you explicit about your politics with them with police officers? Did they ask? Did this come up? You mentioned them asking who you would vote for.
Yeah, I mean, they, like, okay, look, like a Canadian PhD student in sociology, like they were calling me a libtard from like day one, right? So they know like what probably my general politics are. But actually, like, this has been something that more I've grappled with a sociological audience or an academic audience, more so than the police themselves. And so far as like, my first inclination, the first draft of the book was like, didn't take a super strong argument. It was too descriptive. It was too, just trying to like flatly describe or portray the empirical contours of what was going on. I didn't want to like take an explicit position in that way. I wanted to sort of like let the data speak for itself. You know, I was thinking more in terms of writing an article, like I'm testing a hypothesis, I'm rubbing it up against empirical reality, seeing what's going on. But, you know, then when colleagues read the first draft of the book, they were like, this is a book, you have to make a really strong argument. And so then it was really in the revisions phase when that, that argument came out more and more. And insofar as the op-ed, I mean, the op-ed was like, I would say it actually wasn't particularly political. It basically, so, you know, when you're writing an op-ed, you need to think about who the audience is. And so the audience was the residents of Los Angeles, right? The taxpayers in LA. And basically the argument in the op-ed was like, your money is going towards all this surveillance tech. Did you know that? And like, do you want it to? And by the way, like there's no evidence that it works. And so that was sort of the argument in the op-ed, which, you know, isn't like necessarily political. That's more like, you know, having to do with politics and resource allocation and that type of thing. But But yeah, so, I mean, it was interesting, but I think that, like, you know, from the beginning, just sort of like being a PhD student in sociology, they had estimations of where I may lie on the political spectrum. And that did actually, almost that clarity, like, helped them to be more open. You know, right. It's like it didn't preclude them from speaking openly with me. In fact, like, you know, many of them were like, oh, we want to try and win you over and that type of thing. But yeah, it has been interesting. Definitely.
Well, to shift gears, just quickly, you mentioned, you know, things that got stories, vignettes, experiences that didn't make it into the book that got left on the cutting room floor, which, I mean, I think we all experience that as ethnographers, right?
Yeah.
This is a question that we love asking our guests. Can you think of maybe one incident, one experience that didn't make it into the book, but that somehow left a deep impact on you, or that was fascinating, or basically that you want to use this space to tell?
Yeah. I mean, I love hearing this in other people's field work too. And like, I think, you know, I want there to be like I don't really want to edit it, but I want somebody to do, you know, a special issue of a journal, where we just publish like almost atheoretical, just like chunks of people's field work, their field notes. Like, you know, yeah, this doesn't fit into some broader argument, about something, but like, this is an empirical fact that I think is interesting that people should know. You know, I would love to read that kind of thing. So yeah, in the context of my work, I mean, a lot of the gender stuff I didn't write about. But I mean, I think that when I think back, it really is like, and this just doesn't come through at all in the book, is like the sadness, the like profound sadness that I observed. And by that, I just mean like the sadness of many of the incidents that we would respond to on ride-alongs. You know, it would be like somebody holding a baby, like screaming and crying amidst like a domestic violence incident. Or, you know, what I didn't know is how many people call the police because they're suicidal, like because they want to kill themselves and they have no one else to call, so they call the police. Like I didn't know that. Or, you know, people struggling with mental illness. And so like, if you think about it, the police are responding to calls like that people made or people around them made on what's often the worst day of their lives. And, you know, I think that an important question is like, what would happen if the police showed up on the worst day of your life? You know, do they make it better? Why are they the ones who are responding? Like, my take is that it kind of speaks to like the anemic welfare state that we have in the US, mm-hmm. the lack of other social services, how like resource deprived some folks are, both materially and relationally, you know, that it's like, okay, I have to call the police because I'm about to kill myself, you know? And that it was just like, so sad. I would finish ride-alongs like very, very tired, just because there was such like a profound sadness in a lot of the cases.
Yeah, that's really heartbreaking, even to hear, you know, the descriptions that you've like briefly offered us, and just really, really, really sad. Yeah, I wonder what that does to people doing this job on a day-to-day basis, right? Was that something you picked up?
Yeah. I mean, so look, I think there's a term for this. I forget what it is, but it's basically like creating sort of a cognitive dissonance, or like a distance between, because if you think about it, like, you know, EMTs and stuff, they have to do this as well.
Right.
Like you can't have, like if you have, you know, somebody in an ambulance at work showing up to you after you're in a car accident, and they're all like, oh my gosh, like crying and stuff. Like they're not going to be able to do their job effectively. And so I think like professionally, frontline responders, like they have to create sort of a distance. But I do think that doesn't mean that it doesn't wear on them. Right. And I think that like one of the things that I did observe is that people lie to the police all the time. right? Mm-hmm. And because, like, you know, you're about to get arrested, or you're about to, like, whatever, you're going to lie and say, like, no, I wasn't doing that, or no, that wasn't me. And, you know, so how does it affect you as an individual if people are, like, lying to you day in, day out? A lot of officers that I talked to, they were, like, very, very distrusting in their personal relationships. They, like, often would think that their wives and girlfriends were lying. Or, and look, like, I have no idea if their wives and girlfriends were lying to them or not. But they would express that a lot. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm inclined to think that how much lying goes on in their everyday lives played into that a bit. But yeah, I don't know. So that, you know, that's another example of something I definitely didn't write about, but is curious to me.
Super interesting. But just to, I guess, change the mood of the conversation.
Sorry for the bummer. My apologies.
No, not at all. This is very interesting. Yeah, but, you know, what were the ethnographies you were inspired by while doing your work? Or I guess another way to put it would just be, what ethnographies shaped this book?
Yeah. I mean, I love reading ethnographies. I find them, like, really immersive, really inspiring. And sometimes I make a practice, less so just because I, like, don't have enough time, but I would make a practice of, like, reading for 20 minutes before starting writing, and reading something that was high quality before starting writing, because it kind of, like, I think, you know, rewires your brain to sort of be thinking in a particular way, in a particular cadence and stuff. And so I do really enjoy that. And ethnography, I feel, is, like, what works best for that. And I mean, in terms of thinking of specific stuff, Forrest Stewart's, like, Down, Out, and Under Arrest inspired this work in a lot of ways, in the sense that I think that his work, I mean, also his new book, Ballad of the Bullet, is
so good.
Like, it just didn't exist, you know, then. But yeah, his work is, like, this rare combination of being really theoretically rich but readable, and also empirically careful. And in a lot of work, I think that's kind of a trade-off, right? Like, it can be super, super theoretically dense, but then, like, it's a slog to get through.
Right.
Or, you know, it's, like, really, really empirically careful and detailed, but, you know, not particularly theoretically rich, which is fine. It's a different thing. But I think that his work, is a fine balance of those different things. And also, like, it, just in the context of Down, Out, and Under Arrest, you know, like, it took place in LA and Skid Row. And, you know, I didn't do fieldwork directly on Skid Row, but just being in LA, there was a lot of context and included a lot of material on the police, of course. So yeah, I think that book was inspiring to me, both substantively and also theoretically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of both the books and
like
practically anything Forrest writes. It's really, really, like, I think you put it very well. It strikes that right balance between being so eminently engaging and readable and extremely theoretically sophisticated and useful. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so, you know, we've talked a lot about your book, but we are both curious to know more about what you're working on now. And I guess, how has the pandemic shaped the project you're working on now? How's it going, I guess?
Yeah, so my fieldwork did definitely get interrupted by the pandemic, as most people did. And so I've kind of, like, adapted in a couple of ways. One is just pursuing smaller kind of one-off paper projects that I can do during this time, and then just sort of, like, put the second book on the back burner for a little bit. So the smaller projects that I'm doing, one of them is interview based, and I've been able to do all the interviews on Zoom, and that is basically, like, following a lot of what I saw in the policing context into further stages of criminal legal processing, so, like, following it into the courts. And so I'm interviewing lawyers, basically, in order to understand how digital information, broadly defined, whether that is, you know, information from people's cell phones, predictive policing forecasts, just, like, this massive array of digital information, how that shapes subsequent decision making in the criminal legal process. So, you know, initially I went in thinking like, oh, this is a digital evidence project, right? Like thinking about how the proliferation of digital information means that there's more digital evidence. But what I ended up finding is that actually, like, yeah, there is some of that, but that's pretty far along in the process. You know, the vast majority of cases, of course, don't even go to trial. And so where that information is really coming into play is like at earlier phases of the criminal legal process in terms of, like, you know, plea bargaining, for example, phases where there's like a lot of discretion, not a lot of legal checks, and a lot of it ends up being like not legible or not visible to the public. So yeah, that's like an interview-based project I'm doing. I'm also doing this theory paper with a few different colleagues where it's called Surveillance Deputies. And it's this like idea that the state is like increasingly deputizing surveillance activity to sort of ordinary civilians, which is a longstanding process, but like it's really accelerated in recent years because they're doing that through technology. So things like, you know, Ring doorbells and, you know, the Nextdoor app, like these kinds of things. And then sort of what are the implications then for governance and accountability, the state more broadly, et cetera. And then the sort of like bigger project I am doing is, well, I guess they all are, but is really focused on surveillance, but beyond just the criminal legal system. So, you know, I really think that surveillance is this ubiquitous social process and practice that is ubiquitous within organizations. It's like routine organizational practice. And I like to sort of think about it, or I think it's like more fruitful to think about it, not in sort of like a big brothery way in terms of intent or some sort of like evil intent, but rather this like quotidian organizational practice and that all kinds of organizations and institutions do. And I think it's kind of like an open empirical question how that plays out across different institutional contexts that have really different mandates. So like, does surveillance in the education system look the same and have the same implications as in the criminal legal system or as in medical care, you know, that type of thing. And so, yeah, this like broader sort of comparative work looking at surveillance sort of in broader society is the book. And so I started by doing field work in an emergency room, but that like I literally did one day and then COVID hit, and obviously I couldn't be like lurking around emergency rooms during COVID. So that was that's like just on pause, I would say.
Yeah. Oh, these all sound so interesting, and we can't wait to read all the papers and the eventual book that comes out. Very interesting stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, well, Sarah, thank you very much for taking the time to meet with us. This was a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved your questions and this broader project that you have going of ethnographic marginalia is so wonderful.
Yeah, we also wanted to say that in case you do have these vignettes that, you know, you want to send somewhere, please send them to us. We are more than happy to be the space to foster these marginalia conversations. I keep like, you know, writing a short essay to publish, but then I feel very selfish because I want it to be in the book. And then because I don't have a book yet, I think there's nothing left over as yet. But, you know, if you do have vignettes that you want to share with the world and you want space for it, please do send them our way. We'll be more than honored to have them on our website.
Cool. Sounds great.
Yeah. All right. Take care, Sarah. Have a pleasant day and, you know, a good week ahead.
Thank you. You too.